Hello, and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today, a focus on the working class. First, in a few minutes, we'll talk with Mark Brenner of Labor Notes on the state of the unions. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk with Bill Fletcher, executive editor of the Black Commentator and a model of the activist intellectual, about how the left needs to get serious. First, a few words on the economic news. In our national imaginary, suburbs are places of affluence and even a complacent isolation from social problems. As is often the case with received wisdom, this one's in need of a fact check. In a new study, Elizabeth Kneebone and Emily Garr of the Brookings Institution find that the suburbs are home to the largest and fastest growing population of poor people in the United States. Before continuing, I should note, as I always do when I talk about our official poverty line, that it embodies a very mean-spirited definition of poverty that probably undercounts the poor by at least half. That aside, between 2000 and 2008, the number of suburbanites under that official poverty line grew by 25%, five times as fast as the growth in central cities and well ahead of the growth of smaller metropolitan and rural areas. As of 2008, large suburbs housed a third of the nation's poor, and more than their associated cities. Among the suburban areas showing the highest poverty rates were those surrounding McAllen and El Paso, Texas, as well as Bakersfield, Fresno, and Modesto, California, Little Rock, Arkansas, and Albuquerque, New Mexico. The suburbs showing the worst increase in impoverishment were Grand Rapids, Michigan, Youngstown, Ohio, Detroit, and the Atlanta suburbs. Poverty in New York City and the Los Angeles area actually declined, though these figures predate the recession, so that's probably no longer true. Further to the point of the meanness of our poverty line, a family of four with an income of less than $22,000 is considered poor, even if they live in an expensive place like New York or San Francisco. Most poverty researchers regard an income less than twice the poverty line, so in our example that'd be a $44,000 for a family of four, as low income. By that definition, almost a third of our population is poor, remarkable for a country that by any standard is rich and usually praises itself as a land of plenty. A quick factoid that says a lot. The official annual accounting of U.S. healthcare spending was published earlier this week by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. It revealed that 17.3% of our GDP now goes to health spending. That's close to half again as high a share as Germany and France, countries with far better health indicators than ours. Not only that, the public share of our health budget is about to cross 50%. That means that close to 9% of our GDP is taken up by government healthcare spending alone. That's almost as much as Britain spends on its entire health budget, public and private. And again, they've got better health indicators than we do. What a country. Friday morning brought the release of the January employment report. By recent standards, it wasn't half bad. By any longer-term standard, it wasn't so great, but you know, been down so long, etc. Employers shed 20,000 jobs in January, driven by steep losses in construction. Manufacturing actually added jobs last month for the first time in 3 years. Retail employment grew smartly. Other sectors showed mostly modest losses, but the real standout was temp firms, which added over 50,000 workers. In the past, increases in temp employment have led to broader gains. A lot of old relationships have broken down in this recession, so this may no longer hold. Maybe we're in a new regime of permanent impermanence. We shall see. But this does offer some foundation for hope. As does a rise in the average work week, which is now beginning to look like a trend over the last several months. That, too, has been a portent of future job gains, though maybe that's not going to work this time either. Wage growth was quite weak, which isn't surprising with the unemployment rate so high. But at least that unemployment rate declined notably last month, falling below the psychologically important 10% level to 9.7%. Of course, it's still very, very high, but at least it's going in the right direction. And hidden unemployment also declined for the month, with the so-called U6 rate, which accounts for people working part-time, even though they'd prefer full-time work, and for people who've given up the job search as hopeless and therefore not counted as officially unemployed. That broader rate fell by 0.8 points for the month, a very steep decline. Again, at 16.5%, it's still very, very high, but it, too, is starting to go in the right direction. This month's report also came with the annual benchmark revisions. The regular monthly reports are based on a survey of employers, a very large survey of 300,000 establishments, but it's still far from complete coverage. But once a year, the Bureau of Labor Statistics totals up the near-complete coverage of the job universe offered by the unemployment insurance system and adjusts their monthly survey results. Normally, these adjustments are quite small, a tenth of a percentage point or two. This time it was very large, a downward adjustment of almost 1 million. It's really hard to keep up month to month when things are deteriorating so badly. This revised loss means that total job losses in this recession are almost 8.5 million. In percentage terms, that's the worst in modern times, and almost three times as bad as the average recession since 1950. All in all, it looks like the job market is starting to recover, but it's going to take a long time, and it's got a lot of ground to make up. Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the labor movement. That was some of Brahms' third piano sonata, performed by Murray Pariah. My first guest is Mark Brenner, director of Labor Notes. Labor Notes is an indispensable publication and website whose goal, as they say, is to put the movement back in the labor movement. God knows we need some of that. I thought it might be interesting to have a talk with Mark about the general state of organized labor in the midst of the worst economic crisis of the last, 70-something years. Mark Brenner. Welcome, Mark. So the American labor movement, power napping or in a terminal state?
I think depending on where you're standing, Doug, it's a little bit of both. Obviously, things are really bad politically for the labor movement. We're down to the lowest private sector union density we've had in almost 100 years. All of the money, the $500 million that they poured into the 2008 elections has really borne nothing on their key legislative issues, the Employee Free Choice Act and healthcare reform, which is now in a complete state of disarray. And in the public sector, we know that things are bad and only going to get worse. They're looking at something around $180 billion shortfall across the 50 states for the next fiscal year. We've already had almost $300 billion in shortfalls since the recession started. So the steamroller is coming, and a lot of public sector workers are worried.
Let's just talk a moment about the public sector, which is now what, the number of public sector workers are now equal to the number of private sector union workers? They're just about equal now. What does it mean for a labor movement that is becoming dominated by the public sector unions? They lack the power to strike. Their economic power, therefore, is limited. So what does this do to the labor movement?
Well, I think that you can't have a labor movement without organizing in the private sector. I mean, look, that is where the heart of American capitalism is. You know, that's where the behemoths in our industrial economy and our post-industrial economy are. So we've got to figure out a way to get those workers into the labor movement. But I think that having a strong public sector union movement is actually important, especially around some of the key areas like healthcare, education, which are also crucial terrains for struggle right now. The vision that the Obama administration has for public education is not the vision that I think most teacher unions have. And if I had to vote with one, I'd vote with a teacher union vision.
As I recall New York City labor history, the city was very determined that the unions, municipal unions, not enter into any kind of alliance with the public to defend or expand public services. Are the unions in the United States, public sector unions in the United States, doing anything to make those sorts of alliances with the public in this time of budgetary crisis?
Well, I think from New York you get a little bit of a skewed point of view because we're really behind the curve in terms of what's happening nationally. If you look at Chicago, the Chicago teacher union activists have been the leaders in sort of fighting school closings in that city and really pushing back against the sort of what's now going to be the national model for restructuring our public schools. Arne Duncan comes out of the Chicago school system. He was their CEO and is really bringing that vision nationwide. In L.A., the teachers union there has been on the forefront of not just fighting against school closings but fighting the budget cuts across the board. It's one of the most militant unions in the state of California. So I think that here in New York, what we've really missed is that kind of combination of you know, community and public union alliances. But we're seeing some positive signs around the fair hikes at with the TWU. The new leadership of the TWU is making a point of building bridges with the students and really pushing back on Patterson's budget. We'll see how far that gets them.
Of course, radio listeners can't see this, but you said CEO with a smile. This says something about Arne Duncan's vision of what the school system is like.
Yeah, he actually is sort of made quite a splash this weekend when he said that it took Hurricane Katrina to bring real educational innovation to the New Orleans public school system, which essentially was code for saying it allowed us to wipe out the teachers union and put charter schools everywhere in that city. It was he said it with a straight face, and I think that unfortunately he meant it. That's exactly what he wants to bring to most of the major cities in the country, and I think if the Obama administration gets their way with this Race to the Top initiative that they're implementing, that's exactly what teacher union activists are going to be facing, is the charterization of everything and essentially the elimination of teacher unionism as we've known it.
Change we can believe in, isn't it? Let's talk a bit about the Obama administration, and you hinted at this earlier. The labor movement spent $500 million on these elections and have very little to show for it. Are they ever going to learn?
Well, I think that what this really reflects is sort of a silver bullet strategy, which has kind of infected most of the people in Washington, which is to say that if we can actually get Democrats in control, get 60 seats in the Senate, we can push through major legislative initiatives, and then that we won't actually have to do the really ugly, messy work of confronting corporate America and actually fighting on the job, you know, in the trench warfare and in the sometimes much bigger battlefields with these behemoths. And I think that what they've learned is that the people who they are afraid to fight, you know, in the workplace are the same people who are, you know, dominant in the political sphere, and that's why our legislative agenda hasn't gone anywhere. So I'm hoping that they're going to find a plan B that looks a lot more like the kinds of skirmishes and sometimes open warfare that we had in earlier decades.
But it would also help them a lot to have friendlier people in power, and yet they keep writing checks to people who turn around and betray them. So any chance that they might support a more favorable slate of politicians instead of just writing checks to Democrats without thinking?
Well, I think that's probably the most open discussion of that we've seen since the Clinton administration right now in the labor movement. I mean, I was talking with a labor leader up in Massachusetts who was telling me that he's never seen his members matter than they were about this healthcare excise tax on fairly expensive healthcare plans, which was going to hit union members in his local very hard. And he said, you know, not even NAFTA. I mean, these were people who work for General Electric. They make aircraft engines. Not even NAFTA, which was really opening the floodgates to international competition and really hammered their union and their industry. That even that didn't piss them off as much as this excise tax on healthcare, and that's partly why they voted for Scott Brown in the Massachusetts election. So there's definitely forces from the right and from the left inside the American labor movement that are asking hard questions about how far they're willing to go with the Democrats. I just don't know, you know, when it comes to pulling the trigger, either writing a check for a different party or, you know, something like a WFP style, Working Families Party style candidate at the local or state level, whether they're going to do it.
Well, this healthcare fight was interesting because what really irritated them so much was that it was an assault on their own private welfare states. And the unions were largely absent for the fight for a more meaningful, more radical, more universal healthcare plan. So that doesn't sound like good politics to me.
Absolutely. And it's something that at every step of the way in this economic crisis, the labor movement writ large, I mean, there's always exceptions here, which I'll highlight at the end, that I think are really promising. But at writ large, we just missed the window to be the channel both for action, but also just for, you know, expressing the outrage of the economic system that got us to this. You know, people were just trying to keep their heads down, make sure that they maintain retiree health benefits, make sure that their pensions stay solvent, and kind of hope that the storm passes instead of really grabbing the bull by the horns and saying, look, this economic model hasn't been working for the last 30 years, and we've got to lead the way to try to turn it over, you know, turn it on its head, tax the rich and really, you know, kind of break the banks up or do whatever it's going to take to really set our economic system on a whole different course. And they haven't been willing to lead that fight yet. Now we may be in a plan B moment where they do, because both what they've seen in terms of healthcare reform and what we've actually are feeling on every day in terms of unemployment and the inaction around jobs and really trying to put meaningful job creation on the agenda may lead them to break with the Democrats and be a lot more in the streets with their politics.
Now, when you look at this kind of record over the decades, you have to wonder, this can't just be a matter of personalities or personnel. There has to be some kind of structural reason that produces this serial failure. What is about the structure of American labor that produces these kinds of defeats year after year?
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things that really strike me. I mean, I just finished an article for our next issue of Labor Notes about the incredible booty that American union officials have been taking in over this time when it's basically been a lost decade for workers. You know, you've got people who are so disconnected from the day-to-day experience of their members that they don't get it. They don't understand what's really happening out there on the job. They're just holding on to their $200,000 salary. But, you know, as much as that is part of the explanation, it's really only part of the explanation. It's the sort of sclerosis and bureaucracy which we've allowed to creep into this movement, where people are not, you know, they're not willing to actually tell the truth to one another, to, you know, actually tell the truth about when we're losing our fights, really has left the membership disarmed and kind of disoriented. And so it's been up to, you know, little grassroots initiatives like ours at Labor Notes to try to put a different vision out there and try to help arm people with both the facts and the skills necessary to do something different.
Yeah, do the unions really talk to their membership about the structure of the economy, the structure of politics that produces the world they live in, or they're not interested in that sort of thing?
It's been really hit or miss. I mean, I do a lot of trainings around the economy with rank and file union members, and it's something people are incredibly eager to engage in, especially now through this economic crisis, but are really it's not been something that the labor movement's wanted to try to make front and center a part of what they do every day as an institution. And it's really hurt them, because part of what unions do is not just, you know, win bread and butter issues, but you actually form a major part of the ideology formation of society. I mean, you're a counterweight to all of the Fox News, all of the right, you know, sort of general conservative individualistic wave of messages people get from mainstream media. And we've really fallen down on the job of trying to be a counterweight to that, create collective sentiment, create collective experience, give an alternative story for why things are happening in the world. And only in very isolated cases have people kind of lived up to that promise that unions can be that kind of an institution. And I think they're going to have to do some of that. They're going to have to be much more socially conscious, much more engaged politically and educationally with their membership if we're going to have any hope of actually preparing ourselves for the kind of fights we're going to have to fight to really set our economy on a different course.
I'm speaking with Mark Brenner, who's the director of Labor Notes. A friend of mine who worked inside the AFL-CIO building several years ago said that he heard people all the time say, we have to become social movement. You know, we can't just be a business union. We have to be social movement unionists. And nothing of that sort ever happens. I mean, the people within the labor movement, there are many, many good people within the labor movement. So why doesn't that ever see the light of day when it comes to actual behavior in the world?
Well, I mean, I think that's a little unfair to say that it doesn't see the light of day compared to, you know, 25 years ago, where people were asking people at where labor leaders would be at conferences asking their members or attendees to stand up and pledge their support to, you know, right-wing counter-revolutionary governments in Central America, whereas now we're building alliances with organizations like the taxi workers here in New York City or the Restaurant Opportunity Center, and bringing those into the formal institutions of the labor movement. The Central Labor Council here in New York is affiliated a lot of these worker centers. There's a national agreement between the National Day Labor Organizing Network and the AFL-CIO. The problem is that it's really been unable to turn the gaze inward and say, look, here's where the deadwood is, and here's what we need to do to get rid of it. And that's the one thing that I feel like the split in the AFL-CIO in 2005 really had right, which is the unions that left to form Change to Win, SEIU in particular, had a sense of urgency about, we cannot afford to continue this gentleman's agreement that people seem to have, where I'm not going to tell you the truth about how bad you're behaving, how, you know, far in the sand your head is. And, you know, while their solution, which was essentially, you know, what I would call second-tier unionism and sort of cozying up with corporations, is not the strategy to actually turn things around, they at least had the sense of urgency that we definitely need.
I want to come back to that in just a minute, but right now we look at the damage that's been done to the American manufacturing sector. The UAW is barely breathing at this point, it seems. Can the American labor movement survive the destruction of what used to be its core?
Well, I think it definitely can, and I think it will. First off, I think that there's going to be a whole lot more in the next 5 years, opportunities for, you know, the industrial unions to grow, and particularly the steel workers. I see some real hope that they can take advantage of what is going to be an inevitable expansion of industrial production here in the United States, sort of a both from the Buy American provisions and the stimulus to the fact that there is an effort to try to create alternative energy and wind production and such. I think that they can move on that. And I think that we're going to see not just public sector unions, but we're going to see some of the service sector unions continue to grow, in particular in healthcare. And I think that the politics of those unions actually is far better in some ways than the politics of the UAW was even in its heyday. I would take Leo Girard today over Walter Reuther of his day, and I think some of the leaders in the healthcare sector have far better politics than the William Greens of the earlier era.
Now let's talk about the service unions. It wasn't all that long ago that Andy Stern, the Service Employees Union, was seen as the labor movement's future, its savior. There was a loving profile of him in the New York Times Magazine. That now looks like ancient history. What's happened to SEIU in the last couple of years?
Well, I think the most fundamental thing that's happened is they sort of lost their bearings in terms of who should be at the center of an institution like SEIU. It should be the members. It's their organization, and unions are not businesses. I mean, we sometimes make the mistake of trying to run them like businesses, but they're democratic, member-driven organizations at their best, and when they only really work when they're built that way. And what SEIU decided to do was create a strategy for dealing with the 21st century economy, which really made members an afterthought and relied on what is admittedly smart strategic moves in terms of industrial strategy, you know, understanding the financial markets, trying to find leverage in all different kinds of places. But they built an organization where most of the control and definitely almost all of the voice was centered in a small group of people in Washington, D.C. And if you didn't get on that program, then you didn't have a place in this union. And so it led them to essentially take an axe to their third largest local out in California, and trustee this very vibrant, by all measures, very healthy union that was the United Healthcare Workers West. I think that their organization may never recover from the insanity that they've brought upon themselves, not just with the trusteeship of UHW, but also with this fight that they've picked with Unite Here.
Yeah, tell us about that.
Well, basically, several years back, right around the time of the split in the AFL-CIO, following the advice of consolidation that Change to Win unions were preaching to the rest of the labor movement, two of the confreres of Andy Stern, Bruce Rayner, who was the head of Unite, the Textile Workers Union, and John Wilhelm, the head of the Hotel Workers Union, merged to form Unite Here. It was somewhat of a marriage of convenience. Unite had very few members and a lot of money. HERE had a lot of members and not a lot of money. And they were in a growing industry. Unite was in a somewhat shrinking industry. But depending on which side you listen to, the marriage didn't work, and they want a divorce. The Unite side folks do. And Andy Stern, in his infinite wisdom, decided that he would basically engage in some domestic counseling, which didn't go too well. And now he has tried to pull out about a third of Unite Here's members and bring them into SEIU, leading to an all-out war between these two unions. And looked at from the outside, most people think this is insane. You've got the biggest political opening you've had in a generation in Washington, and the labor movement's tearing itself apart. But I think, while I think that that is true, that we're missing a huge political opening, I think it's also been really important for the labor movement because it's the first time in my adult life that we've had this kind of open discussion about what are the role of members in a healthy union, what is the relationship that we are actually trying to build with employers, what does the union really do, what is it for? Those conversations are happening from top to bottom in some of these unions now in a way that they just haven't for over a generation, and I think that is a tremendously healthy thing.
Turning to the broader population, a friend of mine who teaches a course in social movements at a university said that his students, who are self-selected students of social movements, often balk when he brings up labor. That is not seen as a social movement in the way which other things are seen as social movements. The students, you know, kids, late teens, early 20s, spew all the cliches about the labor movement. It's corrupt, ossified, backward-looking, you know the bill of indictment. Is there any way that labor can reverse this perception with the broad public, or are they just, like, stuck with this dinosaur image forever?
I don't think they're stuck with the dinosaur image forever. I think that one of the things that you know, some of the things we've been talking about earlier have to happen before they're going to be able to really recast their image publicly. So long as people are more interested in being polite than being honest, we're going to have this kind of disconnect between what labor leaders say and do on the one hand and what the lived experience of the union movement is on the other. Look, your best ambassadors are your members, and when members feel like the leaders aren't listening, when the union's not doing anything to actually protect them on the job day in, day out, not just deliver the goods in terms of wages and benefits, but just keep, you know, all the daily harassment and surveillance and general, you know, unpleasantness of working in under capitalism at some bay, you're not going to actually really create the image that you need. And so I think that where people are able to function the way they should as a union, the members actually see that and they look at the union in the kind of favorable light that they want, that the whole society once did. I think that there is a particular strain of disconnect with young activists, and some of that is about scale. You know, the labor movement is the biggest outside of the corporate America and the church. You know, this is the second, you know, the most substantial independent kind of entity out there for moving politics, for engaging with the citizenry. And, you know, that size sometimes has an off-putting effect on people. You've got to actually live in the real world and deal with crappy politicians. And there's a strain that we experience quite frequently on the left of purism and standoffishness, which I think turns people off. I also think that they don't do themselves any favors.
Yeah, it's easy to forget, despite all the because of all the shrinkage and defeat, that the labor movement still has lots of people and lots of money to work with, lots of resources. It's has a tremendous amount of potential. So maybe we should close this conversation on a more hopeful note. There must be some good things going on that amateurs like me are not catching. So fill us in on some of the better things that are happening.
Well, I think you've touched on a few of them. Number one, desperate economic times do not, you know, lead everyone to curl up in a ball and stay home. I mean, we've got 24 million, 25 million people in some state of unemployment. We've got a tremendous amount of pushback happening on the job every day. People aren't waiting for Congress. They're not waiting for, you know, Albany to solve their problems. We've got thousands of workers who aren't even legally allowed to have unions who are out organizing, whether they be day laborers working on the street corners of Long Island or taxi cab drivers here in Manhattan or domestic workers across the city. You know, they're engaging in the old school style, direct action and person-to-person organizing. And then we've got a whole slice of unions in this labor movement that aren't willing to give up the ghost. You know, you've got hotel workers in San Francisco that have been on rolling strikes against some of the largest multinational corporations in the world, Hyatt, Starwood, these other giant chains. You've got unions like the public sector unions at the University of California that are leading, you know, one-day strikes, which are now going to lead to a whole statewide strike against the budget cuts in the public education system across the state of California. And then you've got people that are not willing to let their unions just go sour. You know, here in New York City, TW Local 100 just had a really important election. Much more invigorated membership took over. In California, there's healthcare workers trying to build a whole different model of unionism. And again, closer to home, in Teamsters Local 804, the people that deliver your packages from UPS every day, those folks just had a tremendous victory, putting a much more militant leadership in place by quite a tremendous margin. I think about them a lot because I was just in Queens yesterday with 125 Teamsters talking about how they're actually going to make their union into what it should be. And I think it's going to be that kind of patient organizing coupled with taking advantage of the big openings like we see with these budget fights and organizing some of the millions of people outside of the formal systems of our labor and industrial relations law that are going to really hold open the possibilities for some big upsurges in the future.
It has been a classic position of Labor Notes and many other labor radicals that the leadership is at the core of a problem, and if we just democratize and let the rank and file have more power, that would make things better. Is there that much promise at the rank and file level, or is that too sunny a view?
Well, I think that full stop, that's a sunny, potentially too rosy of a view of things. I mean, look, if you're taking over a local like 2W Local 100, which has 150 staff people, you know, multi-million dollar budget. That's a huge organization, and the scale of operating that just administratively is tremendous, much less actually re-engaging hundreds if not thousands of members that have become disaffected and disengaged, fighting a tremendously aggressive management at the MTA. I don't want to downplay the challenges that people like the new Direction Slate, who just took over TW Local 100, face. But I think that what's been missing is the sense that you actually want to take active that members have the capacity to actually govern their own affairs, and that the job of staff and leadership is to actually help develop and expand those capacities instead of kind of tell them to, you know, show up at rallies and, you know, do what we tell you, trust us, which has been the, you know, sort of paternalistic attitude of the historic leadership of the labor movement. I think, you know, for me, part of why I do this every day is because I believe that that doesn't just extend to governing your own union. I think it's about how we can actually run society. We need that practice, so to speak, before we're fit to rule.
That was Mark Brenner, Director of Labor Notes. For more on that great little magazine, visit labornotes.org on the web. LaborNotes, all one word, .org. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program Behind the News. Back to talk about the need for seriousness after this musical break. Slits, who are advising us not to take it serious, or at least making fun of somebody who didn't, or something like that. Anyway, my next guest is Bill Fletcher, a long-standing activist and journalist who gave a very interesting talk to Democratic Socialists of America recently. It's time for the left to get serious. The text is on The Activist, the website of the youth wing of DSA, which I have to say is a lot more lively and inspiring than its grown-up branch. That website is theactivist.org, theactivist.org. Fletcher is also editor of theblackcommentator.com. Bill Fletcher. Welcome, Bill Fletcher. You say it's time for the left to get serious. We haven't been serious so far?
I think that the left has not been serious about questions of organization or strategy. That, by and large, for decades, we've actually been very much on the defensive, very much focused on tactics, in many cases looking for a silver bullet that will result in the emergence of a new mass movement. But we haven't been thinking about what are some of the key elements. And one is strategy, and the second is organization. I mean, without organization, we're nothing. And whether it's a question of trying to influence electoral politics, create new organizations that can engage in that, whether it's to build organizations that are non-electoral, focused on other mass movements, we need organization, and in that sense, I feel that there's a lack of seriousness, that we are almost acting as if politics is mainly about the exchange of emails, the posting of websites, and exchanges of denunciations.
Well, sometimes it also seems like a lot of people on the left think that politics is about taking the most righteous position and saying the most righteous things rather than actually thinking about accomplishing anything. What do you think of that?
I think that you're identifying a very real problem, that politics in a real sense is about coalition building. It's about bringing together a critical mass of people and movements that actually can have an impact on the real world. Politics is not mainly about stating the most righteous position. It is about taking a moral position. It is about integrity. But politics has to involve the bringing together of people that may not necessarily see themselves as sharing the same interests.
I think, well, at least ever since the 60s, a lot of people on the left have been concerned that engaging with power in any meaningful or practical way is tantamount to selling out or somehow compromising or sullying yourself. There are certainly well-grounded reasons for that position, but how do we get beyond that? How can you engage with power in the kinds of ways you're talking about without that kind of destructive compromise or sellout?
I think that the danger of sellouts or people being sold out is always there. So there is no inoculation. What we need, however, are organizations, political parties particularly, that have a vision, a clear vision, and have some sort of accountability system, so that what we're not dealing with is a constant return to the politics of the personality. You know, who happens to be running for office, who happens to be leading a particular struggle. We need to create organizational forms where there are leaders, but there is a very active, engaged rank and file. And I think that takes us down the road to dealing with some of our fears around sellouts. But ultimately, there is no inoculation. It is a constant challenge that any movement has. And in fact, this may sound odd, the political right has much the same fear that their leaders will compromise. It's always a danger.
Well, I guess it's time to get more specific. Let's talk first. About a year ago, there were many people on the left, even very serious hardcore leftists, who had a tremendous amount of hope for the incoming Obama administration. Those hopes, a year later, if not completely dashed, are looking very seriously wounded. How do you diagnose the relationship of the left to the Obama administration in 2010?
I think that that many leftists and many progressives misassessed Barack Obama from the beginning. And it was one of the things, and I'm not trying to get into an I told you so at all, but it was one of the things that I and a number of other people were raising as the campaign was unfolding, that one had to understand who he was and what his politics were. And the fact of the matter is that his politics were not qualitatively different from Hillary Clinton. Now, that said, he had a base that was, and that base was very, very energized. But unfortunately, too many people saw in Obama what they wanted to see as opposed to what was there. An example is around the wars. So Obama emerges as a candidate in large part because of his stand on the Iraq War. Unfortunately, many people ignored or denied that he was even before being elected, interested in pursuing a war in Afghanistan. He said it. Now, many people didn't want to hear it. They assumed that his stand against the Iraq War would somehow translate into a different position on Afghanistan. There was no basis to believe that. Yet people did. And so I think that part of the mistake was that there was a misassessment and there was an engagement in magical thinking. But I think that the other problem, and the problem that I'm very concerned about right now, is actually less Obama and more his supporters or the people that elected him. That what's happened is that because he hasn't delivered on magic, and I know it sounds very facetious, but I'm being very pointed. Many people are despairing. Instead of recognizing that there is an opening that exists, but it exists to the extent to which we mobilize, to the extent to which we put pressure. Now, when we put pressure, the administration is not going to like it, which is going to mean that many people that like to be in Obama's presence, that like to have the opportunity to go to the White House, are not going to be invited. And they will be on the outs. And I think that we should look at that as a cost of doing business. That it's not that important whether we get to sit in the White House. What's important is whether we get the White House to do what needs to be done. And this is something that people seem to have forgotten.
I was amazed to read in your piece that some national labor leader whom you don't mention, whom you don't name, said that it's better to be inside at the table and get nothing than it is to be standing outside and not be at the table at all. If you're standing outside, you could at least threaten to burn the place down.
You know, it was surprising when I heard it. But what it reflects, and we saw a lot of this in the Clinton era, which is one of the things that I was, you know, many of us warned prior to the election of Obama that there could be a repeat of the Clinton era. But I saw in the Clinton era this same phenomena that you had labor leaders that were so enthralled by the idea of being in the White House, of having access to the president, that they did not want to rock the boat. And part of what I think the thinking is, to put it all in its best light, and I don't really have much of an interest in doing that, but I'm going to try to be fair, is that the labor leader that made that statement, he and others may be engaging in a certain calculus. In other words, they may say, we will get nothing now, today, from let's say from healthcare. But as long as we don't rock the boat, we always have the chance of coming back on another day and getting something else that we want. So I think that there's a certain level of calculus that's going on that is extremely opportunistic, understandable on a certain level, but very opportunistic. So I think that that's another factor that we're watching unfold. I don't think it excuses it in the least. I think it's absolutely absurd to take such a position, but, you know, people do.
Well, I've long wondered, you know, why they keep writing big checks to the Democratic Party. They've spent like $500 million in the last election and getting nothing in return. Is it really just the ego rewards of an invitation to the White House? Is that really at the root of this repeated abusive relationship?
No. I think it's more complicated than that. I think that fundamentally the problem rests with the nature of the U.S. electoral system. That's the fundamental problem, that because of the winner-take-all presidential system, it is very difficult to envision going an independent route. I think that we just have to accept that that's part of what's happening. I mean, these leaders are not stupid. We can disagree with them, but they're not idiots. But what you see is this problem of feeling that, well, there's nowhere else that we can go. Therefore, we have to cut the best deal that we can. Now, I think that labor should have a very different approach, which is not the idea of creating a third party at this point, but the idea of developing organizations, electoral organizations with community-based groups that actually can run our candidates. That's where we should be putting the money. That's where we should be putting the expertise.
Run candidates in Democratic primaries, you mean?
That's right. That's absolutely right. Because, you see, what we have to realize is that there is no Democratic Party. There is Democratic parties, plural. And you have within the so-called Democratic Party about three or four other political parties. They're just not called that. They're called caucuses. You have the Blue Dogs, for example, and you have the Progressive Caucus. These groupings have very little in common, and they happen to be called Democrats, but they have very little in common. And so I think that it's critical that we get this factor. This influences the way that we can go about things, and it also helps us to understand why a Democratic majority in both houses is actually insufficient and in some ways is misleading.
I'm speaking with Bill Fletcher, executive editor of the Black Commentator and the former president of the Trans-Africa Forum. What about political organizations outside these parties? You gave this address to the Democratic Socialists of America, which has been around a long time. What would the role of organizations like that be in your picture of a more serious left?
I think we have to ultimately build a political party that is not primarily electoral at this point, that is explicitly a party of the left. I think that that's what we need. I think we need something that is capable of bringing together leaders and activists from various social movements that are prepared to struggle, that are looking desperately for direction, that are looking for connections, and may ultimately sometime way down the road run for office. But right now, that's not the principal concern. And so when you have an organization like the Democratic Socialists of America, as I've said to them, they need to be engaging with other forces on the left to build a identifiable organization and ultimately a party that represents left politics, that is unapologetically anti-capitalist. That's what I think we desperately need. And insofar as we don't work towards building something like that, we inevitably either end up tailing the Democrats or engaging in primarily symbolic politics. I don't think we should be doing either.
You also suggested running candidates in Democratic primaries. At the same time, you're saying not advising against tailing the Democrats. How do we balance these competing strategies?
Good question. I think that there need to be progressive organizations that run candidates in the Democratic primaries, just as in the early 20th century, you had the nonpartisan leagues that did this in the Midwest. The Democratic primaries are a venue for struggle. It is a way of actually moving our politics. That's not a question there of believing in the Democrats. It's about that, given that we have a winner-take-all system, it is a place that we can actually engage people politically. We can talk politics, and ultimately we can run with the objective of winning, not simply to wave a flag. That's where I get really frustrated. We should not be thinking simply about waving a flag and that, you know, we'll have the most progressive stand and everyone will rally to us. We need to be thinking about winning. And one of the issues that that is faced when we're running outside of the Democrats is, and I say this time and again, Doug, that the voter has to decide whether they vote their conscience or they vote for the party that will kick their rear end the least. To break from that dichotomy, we should be running within the Democratic primaries where possible. And where it's not possible, then we certainly should run independently.
It's long struck me that it's a mistake for people like us to get deeply involved in presidential politics. Things at that level are just too stacked in favor of the bourgeoisie. It seems much more fruitful to, like, maybe the House of Representatives and below. What do you think of that?
I think that strategically we should concentrate, we on the left should concentrate on local and state elections and House of Representatives. I think that there are ways that we can participate in senatorial and presidential races, but we need to do it with the idea of building something. This is what intrigued me in the 1980s about the Jesse Jackson campaigns, that there was a potential to build something lasting. The problem, of course, is that Jackson had a different agenda and he had the numbers so that he was able to outmaneuver the left at a critical moment. But nevertheless, that said, in a number of states, Vermont, Alabama, several other places, there were political organizations that came out of the Jackson campaigns that are still in existence and very active and very well rooted. So I think that there is a way of engaging in the presidential races, senatorial races, and other races that help us to build something. But here's the problem, Doug, and it's very, very fundamental. In the United States, we have an extremely short attention span, extremely short. We do not like to think beyond 6 months or a year. We don't like to think in terms of developing a strategy that's 5, 10, 15 years in length. So what happens again and again is that every electoral cycle, many very good activists get sucked into races, but don't take time to stop and think about electoral strategy. And sometimes, very ironically, they reject the idea of electoral strategy. I have seen people go through an election campaign, I mean, be up to their shoulders in an election campaign, completely immersed in it. And after the campaign, it's like they want to go take a shower. And you don't see them. They don't want to be involved in electoral work until the next election cycle. We need a break from that. We need to be thinking about electoral work strategically and the relationship of electoral work to non-electoral work, because I don't think that the left should just be putting itself into the election electoral arena. I think that we've got to be thinking on a number of different levels. Basic survival. We need to be helping to form unemployment councils. We need to be working with people to build industrial cooperatives. We need to be obviously fighting these wars. We need to be supporting the Palestinians. I mean, there's any number of things that we need to be doing. So it's not just electoral, but if we're going to do electoral work, you know, we've got to do it differently, Doug.
Well, it seems like in the last few elections, the left's engagement with electoral work was around a candidate like Nader. Now people are talking about McKinney or Cindy Sheehan. It's always these personalities, the thing lasts for 6 months or a year, as you say, and then peters out. How do you see building some kind of longer-term engagement that uses electoral work as an opportunity, but you know that's not really what the final goal really is?
Well, what I've noticed with a number of these campaigns, including the Nader and McKinney campaign, is that the candidates will say the right things. I don't mean programmatically. They'll say, we're going to build a lasting movement. But they don't really take those steps, and particularly after the campaign is over. It's not like we see them jump into the building of organization. They just simply go off and do whatever they're going to do. I think that the different approach would be more something like what Progressive Democrats of America is doing. Or there's a number of local projects around the country. The Independent Political Organization in Chicago, where you actually are building an organization that then starts to think about, we've got to create a base and we've got to run candidates. So rather than building on the basis of a candidate, we do it the other way. Back in 2004, I had an opportunity of speaking with Congressman Kucinich when he was running, as you remember, in the Democratic primary. And, you know, I liked him a lot. I liked a lot of what he had to say. I chose not to get involved in his campaign, but that's another story. But I met with him, and I asked him about the longer term. And he gave me, you know, the answer that I wanted to hear, which was that this was part of building a movement. However, with all due respect to the congressman, after the campaign, what I did not see was him paying attention to organization building and movement building. He's a great advocate, an outspoken one, very ferocious, and I love it. But we need more. We need people that are going to build organizations. And the thing that we've got to realize is that many of the people that are capable of building organization are not necessarily going to be candidates for office. And the reverse is just as true, that many candidates, good candidates, couldn't organize their way out of a paper bag. So we've got to bring these two talents together. It's been done before.
And finally, I mean, here we are at this present moment with a lot of people disillusioned with the way Obama has turned out. We also see probably the most energized portion of the population are the people with tea bags in their heads. What do you recommend as the proper strategy for people like us, you, me, and the listeners here right now, to deal with this, which doesn't look like a terribly promising situation?
Well, I think we've got to stop crying, first of all. I remember, you know, when I was a kid, getting beaten up and crying, and first thing my father said is, first thing you got to do is stop crying. So that's the first thing we've got to stop doing. We've got to stop crying and bemoaning the situation. There was a tremendous victory in November 2008. millions of people, including huge numbers of people that had been previously disconnected, came forward. There are a lot of people out there that we can tap into, but they need organization, Doug. That's the challenge. I would say right now that there's several different things that we need to be doing. We need to be building electoral organizations that start going after some of these conservative Democrats. And we need to go after them intensely. We need to be running progressives against them in the primaries. This idea of simply just going along with these guys is absurd. So that's one of the things that I would say right off the top that we need to do. A second thing, that we need to have a show of force when the right wing shows up. When the Tea Party people were disrupting the town halls in the early summer, progressives should have been there in force, organized, to stand up to these guys. Doesn't mean you're defending everything that's coming out of the administration, but we've got to stand these folks down. A third thing, we need to be moving a serious campaign around single-payer health care and jobs. And that means that we've got to get the unions involved as well as community-based organizations, and we need to be in the streets. Part of what needs to happen is we've got to break people out of this sense of dependence on Obama. We've got to put the pressure on him. We can do that. We have experience doing that. But insofar as we sit back and keep waiting for him to do something, it's not going to happen. He is being pressured from the right and is receiving almost no pressure from the left. He's receiving denunciations. I mean, you know, a day doesn't go by where someone will attack me for having given critical support to Obama, calling upon me to denounce Obama. What the heck does that mean, denounce him? I want to know what we can do in the streets. What can we do to demonstrate in the electoral arena that we actually have some power?
That was Bill Fletcher, executive editor of theblackcommentator.com and former president of TransAfrica. You can find the text of his talk to DSA, It's Time for the Left to Get Serious, on the excellent website of the youth branch of DSA, theactivist.org. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this bubbly bit of social philosophy. Power is measured by the pound or the fist. Pound is in the British currency, not the units of measure. From Santigold and Mark Ronson, a cover of a song originally by The Jam. Santigold, despite her streetsy Brooklyn aura, is actually a product of Germantown Friends School and Wellesley College. And Mark Ronson is the son of a socialite and a real estate entrepreneur. So they know something about pretty green. Not sure when I'll be back, but till then, bye.